Anaxagoras, Chapter 2. Though having never seen Chicago, she accepted the position and arrived before the quads, bemused and excited, with the cliché carpetbag in her dainty hand, on a crisp, gold, and scarlet-leafed fall morning in 1951. She soon advanced herself with perseverance, diligence to her tedious departmental assignments, willingness to teach those curricula that others disdained or disliked, pleasant manners, kindnesses, and simple goodwill that almost all found unfathomably boundless. She had beside a first-rate mind, quick, extraordinarily scholarly, and disciplined. Her depth of knowledge, as I grew to know her, astonished me. For she had been educated in the old school manner, knew her Greek and Latin, and was in fact better read in the canon of British and classical literature than I. Even knew much of the obscure 17th century religious verse, which is my specialty. And indeed, it was because she was one of the few persons in the world who may be such an intelligent and well-informed audience to my arcane opinions, on whom I might test my latest theories and concepts, that I so greatly valued our friendship and blessed the day that we had met. Remarkably, such good and gentle people shall have enemies. I know I have them, and I deserve them, in the sense that I have treated others as enemies, but she has never treated anyone as an enemy. In telling you this story about her and Dr. Watson, what I hoped you would see is this unusual young woman seeking out for herself this arrogant incarnation of rational indifference and scientific cruelty, for the reason to understand him, not to condemn or punish him, but simply to ask, why? She was indeed confounded and dismayed by her own antipathies. She would contritely reprove herself, and would redeem herself with gratitude to him for his unbidden kindness to her, and spent her summers with him, nursing and comforting him as he aged with great suffering and great regret, and died of alcoholism in 1958. It was suspicion of her relationship with him that had diseased the attitudes of certain persons, peers of her own department, who believed it was this relationship and her ploy of it that had resulted in her rapid advancement in these years. For others who had longer tenure than she received none of the honors she received. Her research had an eccentric interest and was not consonant with the behaviorist principles of Watson. And yet, she was the one who advanced. It must be, these persons supposed and suggested, that her relationship with Watson was not that of colleague or disciple, but rather like that of the naked female lab assistant attached to the wires of his sensitive instruments. This was not so, insofar as I can honestly infer from her personal journals, which it was my task to comb during her trial for expulsion and the termination of her tenure. For years she had faithfully recorded daily journals in a savory prose in the manner of Pepys, which should appeal to literary interests such as mine, but for purposes of documenting her research in the manner of a Da Vinci, as should appeal to the interests of a scientist. She had journals dating to the very first day of her employment at the university, bound, enumerated, indexed and cross-referenced by herself in another bound volume. These were, and are, the source of fruitful inquiry for me, for I still own them all. But unfortunately, were also the confessional sources of evidence against her. In this particular, however, despite the insinuations of her salacious-minded peers, the journals proved to exonerate her. But her accusers nonetheless supposed she had artfully disguised the truth or dissembled, and they derived evidence instead from the interpretation of euphemisms, which they exacted from selected texts, to wit. And I felt pleasure with him and found that I delighted him, or he was warmly gratified by the attentions I gave to his physical needs, or he was really spent. I was too. Prurient inferences were absurd, and rather the degree of her compassion and his suffering was indicated. And in the end, except for the private churlish amusement of Dr. Rand and his wife and fellow peer to the department, Dr. Winslow, neither such details nor their innuendo were featured in either the official inquiry nor the public record of her trial. The official charge brought against her in November of 1968 had culminated with events related to the infamous incidents occurring during the Democratic Convention, which had occurred in Chicago at the amphitheater in August of that year, and the concomitant violence and depravity in the streets at that time, and the relationship of some of these things to her and her intimate relationship with certain individuals in connection to these things, and had additionally focused, more importantly, upon certain professional behaviors, among which was her research into parapsychology. Unusual practices in conduct of this research, several expressions of dubious scientific opinion which she had notoriously made, and subsequent investigations of the content of her journals and other testimony obtained. A pattern of unprofessional behavior, practices, and ideas were evinced that suggested she may be unbalanced, deluded, and or was incompetent as a scientist, and was, in any such circumstance, to be deemed unfit as an educator and a malevolent influence upon youthful, credulous minds, which have been placed in good faith by their parents to our sacred duty to educate them to the truth and to cultivate a wholesome moral life. Because I read the journals carefully, because I found them compelling, not because it was charged to me to examine them, I had undertaken the odious task to which no one else volunteered to read them, because, since it is not being generally known how fond I was of her, I hoped to absolve her, and even pervert justice if necessary. But because of the merit of their content, and the worth of her mind, and the decency of her life, I found the journals beautiful, and deeply and personally meaningful. Certainly, I read many portions I did not need to read, in order to competently investigate the matters put to me. But I shall try not to digress. I shall try principally to elucidate matters which are pertinent to her disgrace and that may be relevant for a better understanding of its injustice. So many hours did I devote to these journals during the period of investigation, I should have myself been charged with professional negligence. But I think my students rather benefited from that negligence, as I forgave so much, forsook so much, assigned so little, and gave such generous grades out of my guilt. What shall follow is a history of the events which, taken from the testimony given and the journals, recounts the developments that changed her life, and mine, and the lives of many others, and which I also hope offers insight to a brilliant transcendent wisdom that her journals revealed to me, and to which she is now wholly and religiously devoted in her chosen life, and to which I shall shortly be pilgrim. Edith had told me from time to time about her research. It did not interest me very much. She had been investigating for many years the matter of the hallucinatory experience. Sometimes those of schizophrenic patients in our clinics here, or working also with Dr. Rand, whose favorite haunt was the Chicago State Hospital on West Irving Park Road. Traveling with him to jointly investigate hallucinatory experiences of schizophrenic patients and those of more communicative patients suffering severe epileptic disorders, whose seizures were so frequent, so violent and unpredictable as to make life unbearable for family caregivers, or who had become demented or imbecilic due to the brain damage of so many seizures. During the 60s, Dr. Rand spent most of his time at this hospital and its surgical facilities, where they performed lobotomies, electroshock therapy, and certain surgeries upon hopeless epileptics, for which he would be famous, and the research upon whose brains would lead to significant discoveries about consciousness and a shared Nobel Prize many, many years later, but would also result in personal tragedy. How often the fate of triumph is ruin. How very like a Greek tragedy, our hero is justly destroyed by the victory which exalts him. For at the same time that Edith was conducting the most meaningful research of her life, Dr. Rand was engaging in his, the most famous experiments of his lifetime. His surgeries of the brains of living patients, the severely demented or retarded wards of the state, who were continuously suffering from unremittent and violent seizures, were intended in part to relieve that suffering. But it was blind science. It was purely experimental. He would sever the connections of the hemispheres of the brain with the hopeful expectation that electrical activities exchanged between them would be eliminated, and so the patterns of global eruptions of frenetic brain activity, represented during episodes of seizure, would be mitigated and perhaps interrupt the seizures, preventing them. Unfortunately, the hypothesis proved untrue, and symptoms were not alleviated. But by serendipity, at first inadvertently and then intentionally, by stimulating various areas of the open brain on his wholly conscious patients during these surgical procedures, anesthetics being not required, and prohibitively expensive at any rate, he discovered that his patients articulated memories or visions or sensations variously, according to the areas stimulated. This mapping was generally already known. What was remarkable and new to human knowledge, however, was the discovery that the two hemispheres, though entirely disconnected, shall function as wholly independent, serviceable, simultaneous modes of consciousness. We, our brains, you shall not say mind, shall be conscious in a multitudinous panoply of synchronous experience, as it were. We are, therefore, creatures of not one, but many minds, if these individuated incidents of consciousness should be called minds. It was this discovery that a decade later afforded Dr. Rand the distinction of a Nobel Prize, although he was by then debilitated by a rare disease he had contracted from his handling of these brains. Kuru, the shaking disease. The disease is also sometimes called the laughing sickness, due to the pathological bursts of laughter some sufferers display. A symptom which then began to manifest in Dr. Rand At about this time, Kuru is a progressive, incurable disease, causing irretrievable physiological as well as neurological effects that ultimately lead to death. It is characterized by truncal ataxia, preceded by headaches, joint pains, and the shaking of the limbs. Uncontrollable tremors will confine the sufferer to a wheelchair in its clinical phase. This disease was endemic among the Foray tribes of the Papua New Guinea, which gave the disease its name derived from a word in their language meaning shaking. And it was also sexually transmitted to those nearby populations with whom they intermarried. The Foray were known cannibals, and it is this practice which infected them. Hence, the disease is also called the disease of cannibals. At the time of the Nobel Prize, the disease had advanced to full morbidity, and Dr. Rand was unable to attend the awards ceremony. In any event, he would have no longer understood the significance of the award. Ironically, his own brains had become mindless. Because his research required these intensive surgeries of brains at the asylum, he was rarely around campus that year, as I remember it. So I have often wondered what occasioned his professional objections to Edith. How should he have been aware of what she was doing? I should have thought him preoccupied. Indeed, he was. But of course his wife, Dr. Winslow, was always on campus, and she saw Edith daily. And she and Edith could not have been more different or alien to one another than if God had invented the combination to test the tolerance of one to the other. In that test, as usual, Edith showed mastery of herself, but Dr. Winslow had a detestation of Edith which showed like a cat smelling male musk whenever she saw her. I remember a faculty committee meeting which I was obliged to attend, at which Edith and Dr. Winslow were both present, in itself a mundane, if not to say numbingly inane, discussion in this, one of our more banal committees, essential, of course, to maintain the bland nicety of bland normality we call academe, in short, a committee on the protocols of student conduct. But the meeting was enlivened when Dr. Winslow displayed such theatrical offense, feeling she had been deliberately shamed by one of Edith's more tellingly effective but innocent remarks upon a suggestion that she had made. Dr. Winslow stated that brassieres should be required of female student attire, and Edith commented matter-of-factly that many women do not need to wear them, addressing her reply to Dr. Winslow, who, after all, had offered the opinion. Dr. Winslow, poor thing, whom, it shall be said, possesses a rather small and shallow puddle of that body of water, if not to say just a wink of moisture, took this factual comment very personally and resentfully, blushing. And she savaged Edith with a darkly contemptuous loathing gaze that might have done vicious physical harm at a distance of even 40 paces to most mortals. But impervious Edith was plainly calm, as she usually was, unperturbed and blithe, and continued to explain to Dr. Winslow that she did not think it mattered at all whether girls wore brassieres, and that, in any event, some of the girls were quite lovely and perfectly modest withal, and that it is not to be taken as an expression of some rebellion, or if it was, so what, but that it is more simply the good-willed passion of open-hearted self-expression, not political, but personal, such as when her own mother had decided and announced to her husband that she would no longer wear a corset. And well it was that she did not wear corsets, for corsets have been proved to be very harmful to the internal organs, and therefore, if brassieres are uncomfortable, then why not take them off? Dr. Winslow's proposal was tabled. I promised not to digress, but so I do. To return to Edith, Dr. Casey's research, I must say I was a good listener, but I often found her brilliance too blazing to see anything very clearly. So some of what I may tell you may be muddled in my memory by my inadequacy, and some I shall quote from her texts but do not fully understand, except to recognize them for significance. Mind-body dualism is not a matter that I ever seriously thought about, and Edith would kindly tell me that it did not matter if I did, that it was a curse to certain ones, like having acne, and count yourself better that you did not have the unpleasant condition of it. In the 1950s, and into the early 1960s, as I was saying, she had addressed herself to abnormal psychological states and the hallucinatory experience of poor victims of insanity. This was when she spent so much time with Dr. Rand at the state asylums here in Cook County and elsewhere, Wisconsin also. While Dr. Rand, being a medical doctor, addressed himself to organic and medical issues, her tasks were clinical evaluations, documentation of testified experience, observation of herself and others, the collation of this data, the indexing and cataloging of the data, so as to develop a taxonomy of hallucination. Her especial interest was the problem of perception, that the hallucination seemed real and material. Did the subject, in fact, experience the vivid hallucination as a real event might be experienced? Was there ultimately, within the sense organs, within the brain, the artifacts of that experience, as it were, the photons upon the retina for the image seen, the ions for the aroma, the palpability of the touch? How far in its affect did the illusion of reality fulfill itself, insofar as the percipient was concerned? For certainly, we did not see, smell, feel what he did. There was nothing there. Was the hallucination contained within the brains, or was it by some sympathy reproduced, enacted upon the senses which should have received them? It was for this reason that she looked to the instrument of GSR such as Watson used, or to that of EEG. Or to other physiological indicia by which to elicit objective data, to affirm the elusive presence of that tenuous mind of man. But these always and circularly reinforced the uncertainty. Mind and body must interoperate, but in these hallucinations, mind was feeling a phantom body. And if the body felt, it was what the mind thought it felt, and so it felt it. Was there a distinction to be made? Not ontologically, no, she said. Even if empirically, yes. A person who thinks she will die may die in fact. And Dr. Casey actually witnessed this. A perfectly healthy, young, psychotic woman with whom she was walking in the hospital declared that she felt terribly afraid that she was dying, and instantly died on the spot, collapsing to the hospital floor. Although her autopsy showed no disease, no substantial etiology to explain her sudden death, she felt she died, and she died.